Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Seriously A Podcast. Today we'll be talking about HIV. So I'm Rain.
I'm Simran.
I'm Liz.
And today we have our guest.
Hi, I'm Kelvin. I am 25 years old this year and I am HIV positive. I've been on HIV treatment for the past 6 years.
Okay. So before we get into the episode, remember to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, and Spotify. All links can be found in our Instagram bio at Seriously Official. We also have a Ko-fi. So if you want to support us, fund us, you know, you can just buy us a coffee.
Yay.
Yep. So let's get started. Kelvin, how did you first find out that you had HIV?
So it first started with a slight headache one day during school. And I went and I decided to take medical leave. I mean, I took MC from school. Then I decided to go back home and rest. So once I've plopped down the bed, without me realizing, I developed a fever that lasted for a whole month.
A whole month?
Yes, a whole
month. So how old were you then?
I was 19 back then.
Okay.
19 turning 20, if I'm right. Yeah.
Okay. So it lasted for a whole month. So did you do anything about it, like during the months?
I wanted to do something about it, but the fever was so strong. It's the kind of fever where it feels too hot. It feels too hot when you're in a cold room, like in an air-conditioned room. And it feels very cold when outside of a hot place. And every time I try to get up, I'll just fall back down in bed. So it's kind of like pseudo-bedridden for that whole duration. I remember missing out a lot of meals. That's rare because I love to eat food. And because of that, I've also lost a lot of weight during that period of time.
Oh, okay. Before that, what happened? Like, how did you contract HIV?
So before that, I think about weeks before that, I've had sex with a stranger, met through one social application, and then it was unprotected sex.
Okay.
And then that's where the whole symptoms began.
Then when you found out that you had the fever, right, then do you go to the doctor? Do you go to the hospital?
I tried to go to the clinic downstairs. It was like a private clinic.
Okay.
So went there and the doctors couldn't really pinpoint what was it. They only gave me like Panadol to try to like suppress, to kind of like manage the pain. Yeah, and that's what I've been on for during that period of time.
Okay. Then, so after you went to the clinic, right, it probably didn't help much because, like, it wasn't the root cause, correct?
Yeah, it wasn't.
So, afterwards, you probably had to... Do you go to another hospital?
I think once it was past the month, my folks and I decided to head to the nearest A&E to just go get it checked out.
Yeah.
And... Okay. I remember waiting for a few hours and then the nurse approached me and then she said, oh, whatever's there is kind of gone.
Huh?
So it's a bit suspicious. Like, I also didn't know what's going on.
Uh-huh.
So together we kind of deduced that, oh, maybe it might be dengue fever because it just goes on and off.
Yeah.
So that was that. And at that day as well, after that day, I felt like the fever was also gone. It just dissipated suddenly. Yeah, but I know something was up, so I went to get myself checked out at a anonymous HIV testing clinic.
Okay, so like, how did you still, like, you just had like a sixth sense that something was up, lah? Like, or do you have any other symptoms that were still ongoing after the fever left?
No, that was the end of any symptoms, and yeah, I had that sixth sense. I wanted to, you know, just get it checked out while I still can.
Okay, so what was the process? When you went to the clinic, the anonymous HIV clinic, like what was the process that you had to go through to get tested, to get checked, and like to get your results back?
So upon entering the clinic, a volunteer will first approach me and assign me a queue number. So once I receive the queue number, I will head to the reception to register myself. So they'll pass me a form that will state your demographics, like how old you are, gender, sexual partners, and you know, some other information like, oh, where do you find about us from, and what are your perceived chances of contracting HIV, all those kind of questions. So once I fill that up, I will hand it over to the receptionist. They will then hand me a client ID. or a client number for that night.
Mm-hmm.
So one counselor out of the many that were available, they will be randomly assigned the every client number. Mm-hmm. So they just call the number, they will have the form with them. Then I'll sit down and then we'll just start the pre-test counseling, where the counselor will explain certain medical terms or some terms like the window period of testing.
Okay.
Because it takes about 90 days for the HIV antibodies to be fully detectable by the current rapid test kits that they're using. Yeah, so anything before or within the 90-day period, the accuracy of the test result will differ.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's like, for example, if I'm there to get tested for a sexual encounter I had maybe 40 days ago,
mm-hmm.
the result will not be 100% accurate. It'll only be accurate depending on the window period.
Wait, actually I have a question. So like, was yours like a blood test or what? Because like my friend in NS, they say like in NS they have to take blood tests to test for HIV. So like, was that what you did?
Mine over there, it was a finger prick test. So they just prick your finger, they put a drop of blood on the test kit, and then they'll let the test kit react to the blood. Yeah, so that's how the clinic finds out if there's any reaction or any potential antibodies in the blood through the test kit.
Mm-hmm.
Once I've done the test, it takes about 15 to 20 minutes for the result to be out.
Mm.
So at a period of time, you know, I'll be at the clinic just waiting for the result. This is usually the period of time where if it's the first time getting tested, you'll be very anxious because you are by yourself in that unknown place, having your own thoughts to yourself.
Mm.
Yeah, but for me, it was probably like my second or third time there, so I'm quite, so I kind of know what's the whole procedure like. So when the results were out, the same counselor that counseled me previously, they called for my number. I remember they brought me to a separate room, and then we sat down, and then that's where they said, your test results come back reactive. That means that there is something in your blood that the rapid test kit is reacting to. So we need to do a confirmation test.
Okay.
That's where they will draw a blood sample from me, then they'll send to a hospital for further testing.
Okay, so after that, like throughout that whole process, just now I found something interesting. You previously said that it wasn't your first time in the clinic, right? So you had some prior scares before that.
I wouldn't say scares. Mm. I would say I recall reading it up online before, and I figured, you know what, this is going to be my first time doing it, so I might as well just see what is it all about.
Okay.
Because I was 19,
yeah.
Raging hormones, hello. So like, of course I'm going to have sex. So it just so happens that I see that available, and I figured, okay, sure, let's just go get it tested.
Did you feel scared or judged when you went to get tested? And then second question is, do you tell people when you were going to get tested?
So first question, yes, because when you enter the clinic, the seats are fashioned in the sense that it will see who is coming in. So usually once the door opens, everyone will look at you. But it's like human instinct, because it's like you see someone enter in through the door, the first thing you do is just look at who is coming in. So That was the first instance, like, oh, there are a lot of people here, and why are they looking at me? Okay, I'm just here to get tested, don't look at me. Then I just sit somewhere in the corner. And I didn't tell anyone that I was getting tested, because I feel like no one needs to know that I had sex, unless I'm about to have sex with them. That was my logic. I'm like, you don't need to know unless I'm interested in you, so... Yeah.
No, that's fair. Actually, that's fair.
Are you allowed to say what this clinic is?
Yes. It's the Anonymous Testing Clinic by Action for AIDS Singapore.
Okay.
Yeah, it's at 31 Kelantan Lane, where DLC Clinic is at. They operate on Tuesday and Wednesday evenings and Saturday afternoons. This is to cater to the either students and working adults, because usually that's the time where they are free.
Is it complimentary? Or do you have to pay a fee?
Most of the time, it's payable. I think the most expensive is $42 for
That's actually not bad.
Yeah.
For a fourth generation HIV test, while it's $32 for a third generation HIV test. The differences between these two test kits is that the fourth generation tests for an extra thing on top of the antibodies, which are the HIV antigens.
Mm.
The HIV antigens are usually present from 2 weeks after the exposure to 45 days after the exposure.
Mm.
Yeah, so there's a small period of time that it can be detected by the test kits.
Mm.
That's why there's like an extra $10 difference.
Okay, yes, but don't scrimp on your health.
Yeah.
Yeah, y'all feel like there's something up. But is it also MediSafe claimable?
It is not MediSafe claimable because it is an anonymous testing clinic. Their incentive is the anonymity. So that means no name, no ID. They'll just give you a randomized number for that night or for that day. And then when you make payment, it's cash only.
Mm.
Because if you use NETS or credit card, it can trace back.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I think we spoke about this a bit on some other episodes, but it's at home kits now. Like the technology is a lot better now also. So like there's like at home kits if you guys like wanna get tested but are too scared because you're scared of being judged, which is like no shame, no embarrassment. Cause like I understand, I would feel scared too, and I would probably wanna do an at home test kit. But yeah, just putting it out there, we can like link some places for you guys to go check it out. Yeah.
I actually also wanted to ask, are these the same people that do the vans?
Yes, same people. Because
I've like been to like CBD and then I see like a group of people crowded around a van. Then me and my friend were like damn curious. So I like kind of like saw the side of the van. And I was like, oh, seems I recognize this.
The van is one of AFA's ways to bring the clinic outside of the clinical setting. Because not everyone dares or wants to go to the clinic because I don't know, some capo people will just say, oh, why are you here?
No, actually, right, about that, right, like just now you mentioned the DSC clinic, because like I recently went there, like I went there 3 times for my HPV vax, but I think like there was also always like some not fear, but like a little bit of me thinking, are people going to judge me for walking into this clinic? Because, like, I know this clinic also does testing for any sex-transmitted diseases.
Mm.
Yeah, sexually transmitted diseases or infections. Yeah, so I think, like, that's a huge thing that whether we have it or not, we're all struggling to get over and to overcome together. But, yeah, I don't think it should be a fear that we have because yes, you can fear for your health, but at the end of the day, you are in charge of your own body, you know, just do what's best for it.
I believe that comes from a society that apparently views sex as something that shouldn't be spoken of.
Mm-hmm.
But hello, everyone has sex. Like I'm pretty sure you've sucked a cock like probably a few weeks ago. Don't, like, honey, everyone has it. Everyone does it.
So, after you did the testing at the EFA and then you got your results back and you found out that you were HIV positive, how did that make you feel?
At that point, I felt that it was a huge reality slap to the face.
Mm.
I felt that, oh, this is actually happening. And I think I felt for the first time in a long time, I felt truly alone, because this was going to be something that will affect me for the rest of my life. It's going to change my entire life. I could kind of see a lot of like door of opportunities that were originally there close.
Mm-hmm.
And also the worries that I'm going to affect my family, my peers, or when they find out about my condition. So it just all came together in one fell swoop, and I remember during that period of time, time kind of froze or slowed down to a point where there was nothing but me and that moment that I feel, crap, this is happening. Yeah. I do remember crying for about 5 or 10 minutes, quite a long time, non-stop. Then the counselor was just there with me, just accompanying me while I tried to process through everything.
Oh, so they provided you a counselor after you got your...
It was the same counselor, the same counselor that delivered my results.
Like a one-time thing, is it? Like only for when you get your results, is it?
It's through the case, right?
It's through the case. Okay. So every client that goes in will have one volunteer counselor there. So they'll just be the point of contact for HIV testing from start to end.
Okay, that's actually really cool that they do that for you guys.
Okay, next question is, I think something that I personally am curious about is that, if it was me, I think I'll be kind of angry as well that maybe the person who I had sex with kind of caused, in air quotes, this to me. And then I'm just curious, how do you make you feel? Do you feel anger, resentment towards the person? Do you try to contact the person? Or were you I'm just going to move on and push through this?
I think for the first few months, I did feel anger. I was very upset at the other person that transmitted this condition over to me. But I couldn't help but kind of reflect that, that happened. That partly happened because of my choice as well. I took the risk and I made that choice to engage in unprotected sex that can cause this. Transmission to happen. I could stay angry. I could contact the person and kind of bring the person to court and get a lawsuit, whatever. But I realized that it's not worth engaging with the person at all because I've to settle my own emotions and my own self first before I can even think about going after the person who transmitted to me. Yeah. But up to now, I've never. Contacted the person. Yeah, I didn't feel a need to.
Okay, I'm glad that something like you moved past.
Okay, so do you have sex with anybody else after that person?
I did not. Soon after that, that's where the symptoms happened.
I guess I don't know how to ask this, but you know how when you found out your diagnosis, right? Was it very difficult for you to tell your parents, tell your close friends? Do you even want to tell them? What was the thought process of that all?
Oh yes, it was. My diagnosis became a very high risk secret. So I didn't know who will react optimistically or negatively to my disclosure of my status to them. Because at least so far on media, there's no proper illustration of person living with HIV other than that one person who has been diagnosed with late-stage HIV, which is AIDS, bedridden with his face covered, bone thin. That's the only picture or that's the only illustration that we've been fed for a very long time. And because HIV is a sexually transmitted infection, so not only will the person that I'm going to disclose my status know that I had HIV, but I had it because I had sex. And somehow this society, our current society, still views sex as something very taboo. Like once you do it, you're you are a lesser person because you had sex, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't tell anyone for a long period of time. Definitely didn't tell my parents because I didn't know how they would react, and I was still schooling at the time, so I didn't want them to be so affected when I didn't have time for myself thanks to school.
So on that, right, if you were dealing with it with yourself, how did you... Were the medical fees expensive? Because there were medications that you had to take. monthly, is it?
Daily.
Daily, yeah. Like, they were given to you, like, in a, for, like, every month, or is it?
So, I would have to head to the hospital to get my medication every month. At first, every few weeks, mm-hmm. because they have to try and error the medication see whether if it works. Okay. Because not every person living with HIV will have the same medication.
Mm-hmm.
As of now, I think there's over 60 or 80 different types of HIV medication.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Because the HIV virus, it knows how to adapt to one medication. So the idea is that we have to take a combination of any of these 80.
Okay.
Like maybe two or three different combinations.
Like two to three pills like each day, is it?
Yes, each day. Then that's to prevent the virus from adapting to one of it, because the other one will be there to kind of like fight against it.
Mm.
So that's how the medication works.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so at least for me, I'll get my medication first week, every few weeks, then to monthly, then eventually every quarter, if I'm right. Yeah, every quarter.
Mm. How do you like cope with the bills if like, you know, your parents weren't there to help also? Because it must have been very tough to deal with it alone as well.
It was very stressful because the medication by itself is about $600 a month.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, because it's not a subsidized drug in Singapore for reasons I don't know why, but
yeah, it should be.
Yeah, so and I was living off of like a weekly allowance of like 50 a month.
Oh
so
my gosh.
so at least the hospital social worker tried their best to help out, because at that point I was a student who was unemployed.
Yeah.
So I could apply for Medifund, which helps to levy off 90% of the fees. So I have to only pay like $60 a month for my medication.
That's not bad.
Yes, it's definitely a huge help.
Yeah.
600 to 60.
That's a lot.
But for the screenings, like all the various blood tests, that is not subsidized.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was like $200, $400
every month.
For the first time, and then for the subsequent every visit I go to the doctor, I have to do that same screening. So that's about $200 every time. I remember when I wanted to start treatment, I didn't wait for the medical subsidy to kick in.
Because
For me, I saw the treatment as my answer to how to manage this condition. So it was kind of like my safety net, and I wanted to grab a safety net as soon as possible. So I started treatment right away. So that was unsubsidized. I think it was like $700 in total.
Okay.
AFA did help to subsidize $200 off for my first visit to the doctor.
Okay.
So I still have about $500 to settle off. So I think for the first year, every week or so, the hospital will call me and say, you have about $400 left. When are you going to pay up? And I have to tell them like, I will try to pay up as soon as I can. So I have to find ways to get money from my parents. So at that point of time, somehow I think the stars aligned, and then my school had this financial subsidy program. So it just so happened that that financial subsidy program and that Medifund I have to apply for, they both require the same documents. So I just asked my folks like, hey, I just need your photocopies of your IC and your SingPass just to get your gross monthly income. They're like, sure, just take, since it's for school anyway. So I had to lie through my teeth for every 6 months just to get that Medifund in. And whenever I don't have enough to pay for my medication, I have to ask my parents for more pocket money. And whenever they ask why, I told them, it's for school supplies. Because at that period of time, I was studying interior design, and design needs a lot of materials.
Yes.
So that was kind of like my, my cover up story, my alibi.
Yeah, but it must have been very stressful, like to always receive calls like that.
I always receive calls. I have to keep it a secret from my family, so I can't share this aspect of my life that is kind of taking more prominence. And also, I had to kind of lie to them every single day that, you know, oh, I'm fine. I'm fine. Don't need to worry about me. And then they ask me, where am I going? I'm like, oh, I'm just going out. You know, yeah. It does eat away, bit by bit, for a long time.
So I guess like on the topic of like medication, in a sense, is there like an end to this? Is this curable at all? You know.
I believe it is. I believe it'll be curable eventually. Right now, there's no cure because the virus, as I mentioned earlier, it knows how to adapt to any treatment available as of now. So until we can find something that can immediately treat it and get rid of it for good, then we can say that's a cure. But for now personally, I'm actually okay with the condition being not curable as of now. Now it's just manageable, which is fine. Because before I take my medication, I will just look at my medication and I will remind myself that, okay, I've messed up in the past. Like, this happened because of me. So with this medication, now I'm taking charge of my own health with this set of pills. Then I take it. So it's kind of like a daily reminder that, okay, sure, I might have made blunders in the past, but I'm doing something about it now.
That's a really positive way to look at it.
I also kind of wanted to clarify, sorry, before Rain, you go on, what the difference between HIV and AIDS is.
The difference is that AIDS is the late stage of HIV. This is when the immune system is fully destroyed by the HIV virus. So basically what HIV does is that it's a human immunodeficiency virus. It basically allows other viruses to enter the body much more easily. So kind of imagine like you're in your room, it's raining outside. Let's say the rain is like other viruses, and then the window in your room is like your immune system. So imagine HIV is just a giant hole in that window that allows the rain to enter without any limits. Yeah, so eventually your house will get wet, you'll get wet marks everywhere, you'll be stained. Yeah, that's how I would describe what HIV is. Yeah, and basically AIDS happens when that hole is left untouched, like no one's doing something about it, and then every available virus will just come into our immune system and just try to wreak havoc inside. That's how people die from HIV or AIDS related diseases, not from the virus itself, but from the viruses that it allows to enter our body.
Okay, I have like a technical-ish question. It's along that line also, because like, I guess my question, I think I did study this in bio long, long time ago, so I'm a bit murky. But I guess it's like, is it if you detect very late, then like it's too late for the treatment to like help? That's why like you can get to the AIDS stage. Is that like how it works?
It used to be that way, but now with the current combination of medications available, someone who has achieved late stage can start on treatment regardless of where they are at. Whether it's the AIDS late stage or early stage, they can take the same medication and the virus can be suppressed and reverted back to its original state, which is a fully suppressed state. I've had one or two friends who are HIV positive, and then they actually reach the late stage. Then they bounce back from after the medication. So it does work.
Okay. So I guess I mean, because the three of us don't know, but I guess we want to know, like, how, if you don't mind us asking, like, how the medication works on, like, suppressing the virus or, like, and also, like, how it affects your, you know, your body. Because you mentioned how you had fevers and all that stuff. So, like, does the medication come with side effects or, like, does it suppress any, what's that called when you fall sick, then you got the...
Antibodies?
Yeah. Like, you know the reaction, like, when you fall sick, then you got, like, fever, uh-huh. pain, symptoms. All that stuff. Symptoms, uh-huh. yes. Does it suppress the symptoms?
So I should first explain what the virus does. So, basically, mm-hmm. the virus wants to multiply itself as much as possible. So, it does this by entering our blood cells. And underneath our white blood cells as well. So whenever, like as you mentioned, when we fall sick, our body will kind of heat up and try to fight off the virus, right? That's our helper T cells or killer T cells trying to find and destroy the virus. But once the virus notices that the T cells are coming, it'll actually hide itself underneath our cells so that you pretend that, oh, I'm actually a good guy. And then the T cells will be like, okay, sure. Then you just ignore. So that's how the virus is able to multiply constantly. So the medications basically interfere with one of the many processes that the virus does. So the virus has to enter the blood cell. It'll basically create a copy of itself with the cell's properties, and then it will paste up away from the cell and it'll detach, and then it'll repeat the process. So the medication either interrupts the entry to the cell, or to trap it in the cell, or to design it so that the virus will make a dummy copy of itself, and then the dummy copy will just malfunction and die off, or to prevent it from leaving the cell.
Okay.
Thank you for answering me and Liz's very in-depth technical question.
As I mentioned, like, much earlier, I take a combination of these medications. Mm-hmm. So, like, my combinations, it either prevents the entry or to just... It's either a combination of preventing the entry plus making the virus make a dummy copy of itself. So, at least the virus cannot adapt to the current medication.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense.
Oh, so you take, like, a bunch of pills, is it? Or, like, just one?
Now, I take two.
Oh, okay. That's so interesting. I didn't even know that there was, like, so many treatment available.
So just now back to when you were telling us about your family and how you were trying to deal with it alone. Were you able to tell, like, the other people around you, like your friends maybe?
I first told... Okay, it started when on Facebook I noticed there was a project called Paint the Town Red. Mm-hmm. It was a final year project by some NTU students. Mm-hmm. And their goal is to kind of like spread the awareness about HIV, HIV infections amongst our age, and try to reduce the stigma associated with HIV. Mm-hmm. So I reached out to them and I told them that, hey, I'm someone's just recently been diagnosed. Mm-hmm. I am within this age group. I'm gonna talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
So they were very eager, and I went to meet them for the first time. Together with a reporter from the new paper that wanted to also kind of like find out more about who is this person.
Mm.
So I remember meeting them in my school on an evening. Then that's where we sat down, I think one at a nearby porch, and once everyone's in, I wanted to talk about it, but once I opened my mouth, I started to cry.
Mm.
And I remember crying for like, I remember making everyone cry for like half an hour for the period of time. But as I was crying, like, it was just me expressing all that anguish, mm-hmm. and all that pain I've taken all this while.
Mm-hmm.
And that was how I expressed it.
Mm-hmm.
That's my very first instance of me sharing about my condition with someone. Like, they are total strangers.
Yeah.
For some reason, I feel sharing to strangers was easier than sharing to people I know, mm-hmm. because strangers don't know who I am.
Yeah.
So whatever I tell them now, that will be the version of them that they will know. That eventually there was a, they hosted an event, like kind of like finale sharing, where I in a private event will just share about my story. And I recall inviting the doctors who had taken care of me from day one over as well. Mm-hmm. So they were there, and then that's where I shared my story for the first time in front of, I think, 60 people, 50, 70 people.
Wow.
Yeah. Of course, at that point, I also still cry a lot. And then I made everyone cry as well. I can still remember. Like,
but it was very brave of you to be able to stand up there and there were so many people. Because, yeah. I mean, yeah, there's definitely a stigma that is surrounding HIV even until today. So it's not something easy to do, lah.
Definitely. And after that, I started, I think AFA reached out to me, and they wanted me to kind of like share my story again to their volunteers, like new volunteers who are going to start volunteering for the first time. So they get to see like the lived experience. And after I shared my story with the volunteers, I noticed that they did not treat me any differently. They treated me as a person for the very first time. Like, they don't care what I have. They just appreciate that I was able to be vulnerable to them, and they appreciate it a lot. So that's where my confidence in sharing my story started from.
Mm.
Yeah, eventually I did disclose my status to some of my schoolmates. And then eventually to my parents, like many years later.
Many years later. Oh, wow. Okay.
I think about like 3 years later.
Okay. So how did HIV affect your daily life? Like maybe with the relationships with the people around you, or like when you shared with your parents, for example, like what was their reactions?
So for my parents, they reacted very differently.
Mm-hmm.
I expected my dad to throw me out of the house and scream at me. But for my dad, he was surprisingly very calm about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very knowledgeable about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when I first told him, he's like, why you do this kind of thing? You know, like, you want to scold, but don't want to scold, because it's not gonna make things better.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned that he knows what is it, and he knows what I have to do to kind of take care of myself.
Yeah.
So it was surprisingly short and sweet. Like, oh, okay, my dad knows.
Mm.
Yeah. And for my mom, however, when I told my mom, at first she didn't understand what I meant, because she's more proficient in Mandarin, while I'm more proficient in English.
Mm.
So it took me a while to try to explain to her what is HIV. So I didn't know how to explain, but to tell her, well, you're AIDS-bing, which is I have AIDS in Mandarin. So she panicked. She's like, huh? You're AIDS-bing? So she thought I was going to die like within a few weeks.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
She was in full panic mode. I can still remember. And it took me another hour to tell her that I'm not going to die. I'm just taking medication every day. Don't have to worry.
Doing this behind your back for 3 years.
Yes,
so you don't have to worry.
Yes, don't have to worry. I can show you all the receipts I have from my previous visits. And I think during that same year, she didn't believe that my medication was working. She thought that I was taking bogus pills.
Okay.
Yeah. And she
placebos,
vitamins. Mm.
Oh.
Yeah, she was a staunch non-believer for a long time, until it was my next visit and I dragged her along to the doctor. Then once she sat down, her whole demeanor changed. She's like, oh, thank you so much for taking care of my son. And I'm like, you bitch.
Okay, like, I think it's like the worry. It's very natural for parents to like over worry about their child, because sometimes when you don't have the proper knowledge of what's going on, right? Like, there is that sense of unease.
Mm.
Yeah.
And also they also feel like they might have let their child down, because for me to not tell them for 3 whole years and doing this by myself, it kind of sends a signal to them that, oh, have I failed as a parent?
Yeah, I get it.
So then how did it affect your dating life, your sex life?
Dating life, I used to think, okay, this is a big part of my life, so I want to share it to the person that I'm seeing currently. So every time, so I made a point to disclose my status to them from the get-go, say, oh, by the way, I'm HIV positive. I hope that doesn't affect how you see me as a person. So half the time they are like, oh, it's okay, let's call the date off, like, bye. Or they'll just be very curious and constantly ask me about how's my life, taking medication, how's the treatment like. And then it becomes a whole Q&A session where they want to know more about the condition and not me as a person. Yeah. So it's a huge turnoff for me. So eventually I kind of like gave up on the whole dating scene for a long time, because I was very tired of explaining. If they can't see me past my condition, then it's a total waste of time getting to know the person in the first place. Sex life wise, by law, I have to disclose my status to whoever I have sex with. If not, I'll be liable for an offense. I can be jailed for up to 2 years maximum, have a $10,000 fine. Mm. So the thing about disclosing is that every time I disclose, there is a 95% chance that I'll get rejected, and there's a 5% chance that they don't want that they will want to have they want to be friends instead. So it's a very it's like a lose-lose situation. I kind of understand why the law is there, just to prevent any potential infection, but for me, being someone who has been on treatment like obediently and having the virus in me fully suppressed to a point where I cannot transmit it to another person, that law is kind of redundant, because I'm already taking so many steps to protect myself. Why do I still need to tell the person that they are at risk when there is no risk anymore?
Yeah, it is that movement, right? What is it called? The U something?
The U equals U movement.
Yeah.
Undetectable equals untransmittable.
Yeah, that one. So like, that's actually like a huge thing, because like when, like last time before we were like all educated about it, you know, it's very common to just be assumed that, oh, when you have HIV, that means you cannot have sex because you're going to infect other people, all that stuff.
Like, you cannot have sex, you're walking disease.
I don't know. There's a lot of really shitty stuff. Like in the past, it was like a homophobic disease, because they were like, it's a gay because disease, of anal sex, that kind of stuff.
And we are like dirty sluts.
Yeah.
Yeah, many, many things.
Actually, recently recently there was that whole the baby thing. You know, the baby, the musician.
Oh, that one.
It went viral because he was like saying like, what if you like are gay and you have like HIV or something, then don't like on your flashlight. Then after that, there was that whole thing.
Yeah, don't have flashlight.
It was damn bad. Like, it just blew up on the media because people were like, it's not a gay disease, it's not a homophobic disease, like anybody can get it, like, you just need to protect yourself, blah blah blah. But it was very eye-opening to see that people still have these misconceptions about it.
To this day and age, sadly.
So I guess like we just also wanted to clarify like the ways that HIV is transmitted. Like, obviously it's not like through food and stuff, right? Like if I share food with you, I'm not gonna get it, right?
Yeah, but in the first place, I'm not going to share food with anyone. That's my food. Like, logically speaking, like, why am I sharing food with you? I bought my own plate of chicken rice for myself, not for you. So, like, you can't contract HIV by sharing toilet seats. But why would I want to sit on a public toilet seat? Have you seen how dirty that is? Oh my God. And also, like, you can't, like, another misconception is that you can contract it by just touching the other person. Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. HIV can only be transmitted through unprotected sex. There are a few body fluids that transmit the virus, namely blood, semen, pre-cum, vaginal fluid, rectal fluid, for those who enjoy anal sex, and very rarely breast milk, but that's for mothers who are HIV positive and they're breastfeeding their infants. But that has never happened yet. Just possible, but it hasn't happened yet in Singapore.
Okay.
In my science textbook, they said if the mom give birth, can be passed from mom to the child from the bloodstream, and also needles, right? Like if you use a
needles, definitely needles.
Yeah,
because as long as there's a clear pathway from what,
like
from,
a wound, is it?
Sorry,
like a wound.
Wound. It depends. As long as there's a direct transmission from one bloodstream to the other, then that's a sure chance, really.
Wound-wise,
it really depends. If it's micro tears within the genital areas, then it's possible because that allows a direct pathway to the bloodstream.
We just want to ask one more last question. So what advice would you give to someone who might be in the same position that you were a few years ago?
I would tell them that remember that you lived before this diagnosis and you will be who you are even after this. Like, you existed before the diagnosis happened and you will exist after that. So it's going to be a part of your life, but it's not going to be your life.
Yeah, like technology has come so far already. And like, it's not, it doesn't look like at all that it's a disease that overcomes you entirely. And I think it just becomes something that you have to go through day by day, you know, take it step by step. But definitely, it's something that you can overcome.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, if there's anyone out there who might be feeling like there's something wrong, definitely go get yourself tested. We'll link the clinics that you can go to below.
But yeah, also something really, really important that we want you guys to know is that please be safe. Like, throughout this whole episode, we did talk about unprotected sex. And I think something the three of us really, really keep advocating is, it's fine if you want to have sex. No one's going to judge you because it's your body, you do you. But just please stay protected because it's really, really important. So go check out our contraceptive video. We talk super in-depth about the different types of contraceptions, the options that are available. But I guess condoms are the ones that, you know, there's birth control pills, there's all that stuff, but condoms is the one that can help to prevent pregnancy as well as to prevent the risk of you attaining sexually transmitted diseases. And yeah, don't be afraid to go get tested. Don't be afraid to ask someone whether they've been tested, because it's your right to know before you have intercourse with someone. Kelvin, you want to add anything?
Yes, I have to add that condoms are significantly cheaper than medication. Either $6 versus $600.
Yeah.
I tell you first. And if you think, oh, maybe the condoms sold at Cheers is too expensive, you don't have to worry, because if you make a $20 donation to AFA, they can provide 144 condoms to you.
Wow. Sounds like a good deal.
Yes. Expiry date is, I think, five years away. So you should have a lot of sex by then. Like.
Thank you, Kelvin, for coming on, for being so brave. If Kelvin doesn't mind, if you have any questions, maybe you can like reach out to him or something.
Yeah.
Yes, reach out to me through my Instagram handle at CDJZ. I will pass my handle to these beautiful ladies. You can find me there. You can contact me there. I'm not shy, as you can hear.
Yes. We will also link down a bunch of like places to get tested. We will link down AFA, we will link down helplines, we will link down everything. And DM us at Seriously Official if you have any other questions. And yeah, okay. Thank you, Kelvin, again for coming on. And then now for real. Okay, bye.
Bye.
Bye.